Okay, girls, today I'm giving you the inside scoop on my favorite place to save this spring. At Ross, it's the spot to get everything you need at prices you'll love. Because when you find brand names for 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices, you'll definitely be finding your next favorite outfit and more. Trust me, you don't want to miss out on these deals on your favorite dresses and tops. And at this price, you might as well throw in a new purse or pair of shoes too. But Ross isn't just about savings, they're about giving back. This year, Ross and their customers raised over $4.1 million to support the Boys and Girls Club and local youth programs to help kids and families thrive. Seriously, just visit your local Ross and see for yourself, because I know you like to keep your closet full and your costs low. So what are you waiting for? Say yes for less at your local Ross.
There are some people who have something we require. And we want you to get it from them.
You ever kill anybody?
I hurt somebody's feelings once.
You labor or management?
If I was management, I wouldn't have given you a secret.
Who and how many are going to be coming after us?
You worried about saving your own skin?
Yeah, I am. It covers my body.
You just can't hold out forever. Impossible.
Oh! Almost a bit raspberry jam right there, eh?
What's the color of the boathouse in here for?
I don't like your attitude.
The color of the boathouse.
Oh, fuck off!
Welcome to Row Min, a 12-episode miniseries on director John Frankenheimer's 1998 espionage thriller, Ronin, starring Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, and of course, written, quite controversially, by one David Mamet and J.D. Zike. I'm your host, Blake Howard, in the fourth episode, what we've called scene four, from 26 minutes and 21 seconds to 31 minutes and 22 seconds, I have a bumper conversation. Firstly, writer and director of the currently in production and post-production movie Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice, Ben David Grabinski, joins me, as well as film historian and the great podcaster behind Guide for the Film Fanatic, Jason Bailey, and award-winning author and dear friend of mine, Jordan Harper. All these guys are so near and dear to me. They have come along for what is easily the most sought-after scene in this entire film. It is the ambush you with a coffee cup scene, the boathouse scene, whatever you want to call it. This is the genesis. It's our biggest bumper episode of the series so far. So let's pluck Ben David Grabinski out of the well of his editing suite and let's get him into this conversation. First up, we're kicking off with Ben David. We jump over into a conversation with Jason, and then we finish off with Jordan Harper. Enjoy.
Yeah, I don't know how I got this scene. Like, why did I get the best scene?
Because you're making a movie and you decided to take a break because you're like, I want to talk about this scene. And it's like, there's a couple of films that I want to make podcasts about this year. And even one of them that we've even talked about before. And I'm like, I could get Ben David to run back a Creed chat. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what we could do that again. It's been 10 years since one of the great movies, but this is one of the great movies. And
I'm in post on a movie right now where I have, there's two car mounts in my movie, and I called them the Kiss Me Deadly car mount and the Ronin car mount. So the Kiss Me Deadly one is where the camera's behind the driver and passenger, like looking towards the windshield of a convertible. And then the Ronin one, I always call Ronin one, even though technically it's been in a million things, and he used it in Grand Prix first, is the one that's low to the ground, and it's like a, I always call it like the car POV.
Yes.
Where it's like, it's basically kind of attached to the bumper and the camera feels like it's going to hit the ground at any moment, but you put like a wide angle lens on it and it feels really intense. So those are the two camera mounts I had, as I, because I'm a maniac, I only refer to them by movies. So you're in a meeting and I just say, can we get the Kiss Me Deadly car mount? And no one knew what that was, but they knew the job was to Google it. And, but the Ronin one was a little more confusing because it has like a bunch of very specific camera mounts, which I do think are the same as Grand Prix. But Ronin, here's some trivia for you. They should put this on IMDb. What is the first DVD I ever owned? Ronin.
Ronin. Yeah. And you are a notorious man for physical media, and bless your heart for doing so.
That was my first, and I didn't even have a DVD player yet, but I wanted to hear the commentary.
That's such a you thing.
I bought it at Target, and I got a DVD player a few weeks later, so I was just fantasizing about what the Frankenheimer commentary was going to be like, and guess what? It delivered.
Yeah.
But the second DVD I got, which I think was the same day, was next Friday. So I guess if you want to know anything about me and my inexplicable taste, it's that my first two DVDs were Ronin and Next Friday.
That is a... You contain multitudes. You can never be accused of not...
None of it's good, but I do contain it.
Oh, my word.
So this movie... You know, it's perfect. I am the world's biggest sucker for tough guy, action-y mammoth dialogue, which is why I am the world's biggest defender of Spartan. But this is the better version of that. But I luckily got to pick a scene that has almost all the best lines,
yeah. You know,
which is great. The scene is also really personal to me because I think that, you know, most of us in real life want to be Robert De Niro, but we're all probably Sean Bean in this movie. And by we, I mean me. I'm not trying to disparage anybody else, but, you know, we all want to be the cool guy who says the shortest, smartest thing, just bounces from thing to thing in life, always crushing it, not having to overdo it, a lot of self-confidence. But instead, you're like the annoying guy at parties who keeps asking questions that let people know that you're just nervous and not as cool as you think you are. And you get everybody in trouble and then they ask you to forget them. So this is the opposite of like an aspirational character. But every time I watch this is just like, that's the real fear in life, is to be Sean Bean in this. Now, Sean Bean's died in a bunch of stuff, but I think it's actually worse to be Sean Bean who gets humiliated and just leaves a movie. Like, because like death is like intense. Like, it's my favorite big death of all time is in Fellowship of the Ring. I think it makes me cry just thinking about it. But this is a worse fate. Robert De Niro movie and you get you get to be in one scene and they're like, nobody, you are not as cool as us. It's just like, what do you want? Like, what? I just, that would haunt you forever. Like, so, hey, what'd you do last summer? I was really good friends with Robert De Niro for 3 hours. And then he ambushed me with a coffee. And then I left. And I got some money, but everyone said, forget we exist. It's like this overt ghosting.
That first story is like, I don't know if I should tell you this, but I was friends with Robert De Niro and Jean Reno for a few hours. And Natasha McElhone was there too.
And he probably has a really unhelpful friend in real life who's like, oh, buddy, that wasn't your fault, when he tells him that story. Because, like, they don't want to hurt his feelings. But, buddy, it was your fault.
100%.
He was not equipped. You know, I think he probably lied on his LinkedIn profile. I don't really know how LinkedIn works. But that's it. It's like that guy forever. It's one of those things when, like, you fuck up and someone's like, I'm sure it wasn't that bad. And you're like, no, it was. What happened? I don't want to talk about it. Just, and then, you know, he's forever like at, you know, like the end of Social Network when he keeps refreshing, he keeps Googling the color of the boathouse at Hereford. Just, he's like, I could have been in the whole movie, but I just didn't know. That's also the genius of this fucking movie, is how often do you see a movie with an actor of that caliber doing that kind of part? Like, usually a really good actor is like, I don't want to do that. Like, I just show up and I get humiliated and I leave. You know, it takes a real talent to be like, yeah, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, I'm the most memorable. I'm possibly the most memorable character of the movie, and I'm in maybe 25, 30 minutes of this thing that goes for 2 hours. And also, I love, that's actually such a weird film nut shorthand, is like, you're sometimes in the room and there's that scary thing where it's like, who's Sean Bean in here? And if you can't see them, guess what? You're Sean Bean.
Yeah. Or that also means you're dead. You're either dead or you're the guy who shouldn't be there.
Yes.
But actually, that is the whole thing. And That's actually the great combination of Fellowship of the Ring, is he gets to do both of those parts.
Yes.
He does the guy who is annoying in a group and is fucking things up, but then he completely redeems himself. It'd be like if at the end of this movie, Sean Bean shows up and like saves everybody.
They took the little ones. He's down. Frodo. Where is Frodo?
I let Frodo go.
Then you did what I could not. I tried to take the ring from him.
The ring is beyond our reach now.
Forgive me. I did not see. I have failed you all.
No, Boromir. You fought bravely. You have kept your honor.
Leave it. It is over. The world of men will fall. And all will come to darkness. And my city to ruin.
I do not know what strength is in my blood. But I swear to you, I will not let the White City fall. Nor our people fail.
Yes.
Like they're all about to die, and then suddenly, like, he has a Leroy Jenkins thing, like a car smashes through a wall, and he's like, "Get in!" And then he drives away. And he rescues everybody.
Coming up with 32.33 repeating, of course, percentage of survival.
Oh, it's a lot better than we usually do.
All right, chums, up.
Ready, guys?
Let's do this, Leroy Jenkins.
Oh my God, he just ran in.
Save him. Oh, geez. Stick to the plane.
Oh, Jesus.
Go. Let's go.
Stick to the plane.
Is that actually how it ends? I forget now. I can't remember.
Well, it's a director's cut that I wish I could have seen, because that would actually give him British. But that it's so sad, Ben David, when she goes, "Here's your money. I don't have to remind you like that it's good for you to forget that this ever happened." But it's, he's just going to be haunted by that. It's just so haunting. It's like, oh God, it couldn't be worse. There's nothing that could be worse about it. And there's a couple of split seconds fleeting before we get to the scene that we're talking about, where he shows that he's got a little bit, maybe there is more, like maybe he could have been one of those cool guys, where he speaks in French, like back to the guys, back to Jean and back to, Mr. De Niro, and he's talking back to them, and you're like, oh, okay, maybe this guy isn't such a like a brash British loser. But at the end of it,
you know, he's like the person I knew who was on The Bachelor, and
oh my God,
they like told all their friends like, oh, I'm gonna go be on this season of The Bachelor, and then they left really excited, and then they got kicked off on the first episode.
Oh my
And I
God.
just think about it all the time, because it's like, all right, guys, see you in 10 weeks, or maybe at a wedding. And then like 5 days later, like, yeah, I'm back. And I think that's like what happened with this character. Like, he told all his friends and family, he's like, guys, I'm about to do something so cool. Like, it's gonna be so fucking awesome. I can't even tell you about it. It's a secret. I signed an NDA, but I'll see you guys in like 6 weeks. And he's back the next day, and they're like, what happened? He's like, I changed my mind. But that's actually the joke I made before I left to make my movie, is like, I left to go to Winnipeg and I had a going away party, and I kept telling everyone like, hey, I'll see you in like 11 months or in a week. And I maybe it's a deep down a thought, like I'd be like the Sean Bean of studio directors.
Impossible. Every frame is stuffed in this, and I think you've probably got the most tactile appreciation for that. Like every single scene that Frankenheimer like does one of these shots, not only does he have
De Niro's on the side looking towards camera, and then a guy behind him is looking at someone else. Like the way he shoots people around a table in this movie,
and like so, and like you know, in a couple of these moments, like Stellan Skarsgård's over there working on a computer, and Natasha McElhone's like doing something, and then Skip Sutter's there like cleaning a gun, and then like you know Jean Reno's smoking a cigarette, but De Niro's the core of the frame, looking at something or planning something and doing it. And I'm just like, in every one of those scenes, I'm just like, they're just so chock full of people, and the staging is so beautiful that like every single time you can't help but have these like eyes darting, because you're like, these are significant characters. What the hell is he doing over there? Like this is the movie of like, what the hell is that person doing over in that frame? And it just gives you something to look at. And even his cinematographers at the time, because this was such a like a bounce back big win for him, because whatever he did on the Island of Dr. Moreau was thankless. He was a thankless gig, and they were like, let's give him some money to make a real movie that he doesn't have to quote unquote save. So when he does this, it's just a guy that finally has all the tools again to make something so great. And he's such an immense, like enduring talent that he just gets it. Like even
he makes it seems easy, and it's the most difficult kind of movie in the world to make. It seems like just a guy sitting in Video Village going, okay, yeah, this camera here, this camera here, this camera here, I'll put this one here. Okay, that guy will be in this one. This guy will be a stunt driver. This one will be De Niro. Okay, yeah, guys, let's go. And you're just like, oh, perfect dailies. I don't know how that happened.
It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's I think it's a perfect movie. It feels like a pulp paperback novel with gigantic stunts. You know, there's just something very... The minimalism of the dialogue is so good. One of the other great things about it is it reminds you of Solaris all the time, because you're like, oh yeah, it's in Solaris. That movie is so good. which like can never hurt. Anytime a movie reminds me of Solaris is great, even though, you know, that movie made $1 and most people I know still haven't seen it, but guess what? Team Solaris for life. And by that, I mean three.
I saw Solaris, the Soderbergh Solaris, before I saw the real Solaris. So that was what people called the original. And also Natasha McElhone's eyes are like the main character in three of the coolest movies ever made: The Truman Show, Ronin, and Solaris. And it's like, yep, that's about right. That's a pretty sick triple feature if you ever want to watch all of the power of movies.
Man, that what a fucking heroic trio of directors there too. I don't know if you've ever heard of Peter Weir. I think you might have seen some of his movies, but yeah, man, that guy's really good.
Yeah, he's pretty good as well. Just the greatest.
Do you remember how exciting it was when Reindeer Games was coming out? I thought that was going to be the greatest movie. I saw it opening night. I was a huge Ronin head, and you know, Premiere Magazine, all these things were like the hottest script in town, Reindeer Games, and then. It's funny, guys, to think of that too, because I think I remember the story was that Affleck wanted Peter Weir and was like mad that he got Frankenheimer instead. It's like, but why would Peter Weir do this? But I was really excited to see Reindeer Games, and I don't even know if I would like it or not, but I was like expecting it to be like Ronin at Christmas. I was so stoked for that movie at the time. As usual, you completely stayed on point. We should talk about Black.
You're just too fun to talk about, to digress onto every other topic with. Is there any final thoughts that you have about Ronan before you go back to actually doing the great work that you're doing, which is making a movie?
I would just say that like his staging and the way that he shoots ensembles or the way that he does coverage in the movie is so inspiring and intimidating, especially because like 90% of this movie was like shot with a Steadicam. But the way he just shoots people sitting around a room, like literally the people who really informed my whole concept of just like how you place actors on a set was like from watching Ronan and the Ocean's movies.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously Carpenter's my favorite, and like he's, you know, great at putting a bunch of people in frame. But at that time and at that age, when I was like very kind of, you know, 16, 17, 18, very formative, knew I wanted to make movies, like Ronan and the Ocean's movies were the ones where I'm just like, how do they fit all those guys in that shot? You're like, because there's like the lead guy, but then you're also seeing a bunch of the other guys. There's just real craft all over the place. And it's like a meat and potatoes movie, but it's like the best meat and potatoes you could ever get
The perfect cut of steak. The perfect, absolutely perfect. And I want to say to you this, just to touch on one point that you said, which is you're a defender of Spartan, which is a very good movie. But it's that someone has already proffered that, like, can you imagine if Frankenheimer was allowed to make Spartan 2? Like, as in...
Mammoth's a bad director.
Yeah, Mammoth's not a great director. And it's like, if you had... Imagine Frankenheimer's eye with that script. He just would have eaten it. Even all the same actors, same setting.
That script is so good that unbelievable. It could have been directed by a paper bag. Like but I think if Spartan... It's the same as, like, Heist is one of my favorite scripts ever, and the cast is incredible. But imagine if that movie was directed by, like, anybody. Like, it's already incredible. Those same actors, that same script. It's the same thing, like, whenever Sorkin directs his stuff, I'm like, fuck off, man. Like, why? Why are you doing it? Like, you know you're not... There's better guys out there, and by better guys, I mean every other guys.
Yes.
But the hubris of me to say that, sitting here making a movie that's going to be like, yeah, that was like almost as good as that Ricardo's movie. So, but yeah. Impossible. But we also got to talk about Jonathan Pryce's intro, which I ripped that shot off so hard and didn't even realize it, but I love it, where it's like a Steadicam shot at the ceiling and it, like, tilts down, and then I don't reveal a guy behind a newspaper because it's kind of hard to find those, but I didn't, like, go to that extent. But it is such, from, like, camera work perspective, music, performance, extras, just everything about it is just so cool. Like, it's like such a great way to meet a guy. You're just like, oh, great. I'm afraid of this guy, and, oh, it's that actor I love, you know.
And now, Jason Bailey.
What was remarkable when I rewatched it today in preparation for this, to talk specifically about this scene, was how short this scene is.
Yeah.
Like, it has taken up an outsized amount of my imagination, of my memory of what Ronan is. Like, I would have guessed, like, for as much as I think about this scene when I think about this movie, I would think it was at least 10 minutes long.
It is the shortest scene. When I cut
yeah.
Ronan into bits, component parts, to make up 12 scenes, 12 episodes, this is the shortest scene, and it was the most dogged fight amongst a really wonderful group of creative people to be like, I want to talk about that scene. And it is so funny that, like, hard to explain, is it, and maybe we'll get into it, but it's like hard to explain, is it like the balance of all the things that happened leading up to that point, and, like, people losing their patience, because obviously Sam, De Niro's character, is kind of losing his patience with this character. Mm-hmm. But whatever it is, the balance of that and that being a hinge point in the movie is just so wonderful.
I mean, there really is, like, maybe it's just the fact that, like, I could easily watch, like, an entire movie of Robert De Niro humiliating Sean Bean. Like, because it's not just confined to this scene. Like, it, like you say, it's leading up to it. Like, he is skeptical about this dude from Jump Street. Mm-hmm. But the way that it culminates here, that he's been observing that this guy is full of shit, that he's been observing that he's a hot dog, that he's been observing that he is, you know, causing unnecessary danger. And then the way he just tees him up to humiliate him in front of everyone is a work of art, the way that he does it.
And you're so right. From the second he meets him, this is people, you know, it's that great line also from a movie with Stellan Skarsgård, which is the girl with the dragon tattoo, which is like, why did you come back in the house? To be polite? Like, you knew I was the guy, you knew you were in danger, and you, instead of being rude, you risked your life. It's like, people don't trust their instincts. There's just a lot of time, or, you know, we're in, you know, sometimes a corporate environment, an office environment, you're trying to impress, or it's a, you know, maybe an educational institution environment, or whatever the case may be, retail environment, where you go up and someone's just giving off a fucking weird vibe. And Sam immediately knows the weird vibe. Vincent's there, Jean Reno, they're like, this guy, something off about this guy. I don't know what it is, but it's just the end. I love that they like kind of trust, like, no, there's something off about this guy. There's something off about this guy right from minute one. It's like, I don't know what it is. He can speak French, and he is kind of stupid brave, as in like doesn't even realize that things are dangerous to go and do them.
Right.
But he is going to get us killed if the stakes raise.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So like, so that's in there. But then what's also fun about the scene, okay, the coffee cup ambush, like that is what lingers for me most about the sequence. And what's incredible about it is the way that Frankenheimer tees up and executes that piece of business.
Yes.
Is both like, he comes into the scene on it. The scene opens with the coffee pot in close up. Like he's not being subtle about this, you know, he's not setting it up like slyly, like, and I can't even remember who it was, but you know, I read some film director saying that like one of the four or five most important choices you make when you're plotting out a scene is how you're coming into it, is what sort of the first image is, how it's framed, how tight, how far. Like these are things that for some people are sort of instinctual, but that require quite a bit of thought and consideration. So like he comes into the scene in a close-up of the coffee pot. When Sam sets the tin mug down on the table, sort of to, you know, as his setup for the gag, he like pushes in on a close-up, like I think there's a music sting there. I mean, like, it's not subtle in the least, but it still kills.
I have the information. We'll be moving very soon. It'll definitely be in the nature of an ambush, somewhere between here and here. We'll anticipate a 3-car convoy with a backup team. And obviously, we will try and stop the target before they can get away from us.
What's in the case?
That information isn't necessary.
Is it heavy? Is it explosive? Is it chained to some unlucky bloke's wrist? We're going to have to chop it off?
All right. What is it? But I'm not under any obligation to let you know.
If you are not, then the price has got to go up. I'll get you the case, but the price has got to go up. If it's going to be amateur night, I want $100,000. I want it up front. I want it in a bank account. I want another $100,000 when you get the case.
And if you haven't seen the movie before, then you see that he's setting something up, but you can't imagine what it could be. If you are revisiting the movie, as so many of us are, you are remembering that it's coming, and he's like nudging you in the ribs. He's like, "Hey, that great thing with the coffee cup's coming. Watch, here it comes.
I'm about to play this movie's greatest hit. Here you go, guys."
Yes, exactly. And it's beautiful. Yeah. And that, you know, and those sort of moments of mechanical improvisation are, I think, what's great about this movie and what sort of separates it from the typical action or even heist movie. Like that is a brilliant moment of mechanical improvisation. So is my other favorite scene in the movie, which I know you will get to and I won't step on anyone's toes, but the business in front of the hotel with the luggage cart.
Oh yeah.
That is masterful physical improvisation. And so, and we're dazzled on two levels. On a base level, we're dazzled by the ingenuity of Sam. That is characterization through action. That is, we know what a fucking pro this guy is by the fact that he thinks on his feet this inventively. But then
he's got like three personas in that scene. He's got Sam.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He's got a dumb tourist, and then he's got like really fussy, like French guy who's angry at a bellboy. Get my basic things through. He does them all interchangeably and then goes back to dumb tourist.
Exactly.
Taking a photo. It's a bit, the acting business as well as all that tactile business is is on, like, it's on rails. Like other guys, you feel like they have to do a pose or whatever, or a face, or, you know, to call attention to it. Frank and Armin just orchestrates this big, beautiful sweeping shot. They're in there and he sweeps out and sweeps back in. It's just, man, it's such a great scene.
So we're dazzled by the character's ingenuity, but then we're also, especially on a second or third viewing when we're aware that that shit's coming, dazzled by the narrative bravado of the screenwriters. Mm. And I'll use the S here. We can get to that in a moment. And, you know, the mastery of the filmmaking, of how Frankenheimer is framing and shooting that stuff, so that we're aware of kind of everything that's happening, of the geography of the room, or in the case of the latter one, the geography of the hotel exterior. So I think all, you know, it's working on those multiple levels at the same time as well. And then you've got all of these inventive compositions, you know, the way that he's shooting the close-ups when he goes to that great low angle 3-point shot of De Niro, Skarsgård, and Bean, the sort of restlessness of the camera work throughout the movie. He's got all those fabulous push-ins that, like, in a lesser director or cinematographer's hands could be sort of clumsy, but they're always just sort of like, oh, wow. You know, it's just like, it's very energetic. It has the energy of a much younger director.
Yeah.
Big time. But I was really struck on this watch by how he leans in on these faces, that he's got these great character actors with these great weathered faces. And he knows that that's part of the toolbox. You know, in this scene when De Niro ups the asking price because she won't tell him what's in the case, like, he lets the silence hang thick as she's considering that. And he has this series of close-ups of everyone who's watching how De Niro's acting in that scene and how she's reacting to it. And he lets each of them have a moment to react to that as well. And that's just like, it seems like basic filmmaking craft, but that's like God tier shit. That's like stuff that a younger director never thinks to grab, you know?
And it's also, it's the lost art of coverage is what you're talking about, which is actually what you choose to shoot. But Jason, the most infuriating thing about contemporary cinema is that, like, he has five or six in that space, in the space that we're talking about right now, of the best character actor faces or leading actor faces across multiple countries you've ever seen. He has them all in the same room giving all this business together. And then in all the close-ups, it's not a stand-in. It's the corner of Stellan Skarsgård's face while you're focused on Earth. I think that's what people don't understand. It's like, I don't want this person to be in isolation. The electricity of that close up is all about where they are in the scene, what they're consuming. And I think that, like, you and I watch that and it feels so obvious for people of a certain age who grew up with, like, big, huge ensembles, and you see all these actors and you know, there's, I think the whole, I think a few people have said this, I can't remember exactly who I can attribute it to, but a few people have said, like, the whole Oppenheimer phenomenon of, like, every person in that movie has been number one on a call sheet.
Right.
And we used to just be spoilt that for an action heist espionage twisty movie, we had five, six great actors all in the same movie. And then there were a couple of other supporting and whatever. But I think in that scene, exactly as you said, that it's not only the electricity of them all in there, in that space together, egoless to just his vision, but then it's like them maintaining that energy while he does the other coverage, or they've got like a second camera just banging out those close-ups, you know? It's really... He's excitable. He's happy.
He is.
who would be happy after surviving the island of Dr. Moreau and getting this much money to make Ronin? We wouldn't be happy.
Yeah, very much so. And so that stuff is also good, but I do, I also love the escalation of De Niro in this scene from the sort of quiet impatience that he's exhibited towards the Sean Bean character in the first few scenes to now he's like, he's fucking had it. And I love that what pushes him over is the thing at the whiteboard. Like, it's a moment, like, you see that is a moment of such pure incompetence that he can no longer stomach it. He can no longer tolerate this moron and his his lack of understanding, his lack of not the fact that he's passing himself off as an equal to Sam. I think in that moment it becomes too much to bear, you know? And so the whole, like, both De Niro and Mamet as a writer value repetition. The idea of saying the same thing more than once, but slightly different, slightly more intense, slightly louder. You see the most obvious repetition throughout the script is what's in the case. Yeah. Like, Mamet loves having a little refrain like that that he can go back to.
Okay. We've got shooters here. Shooters here. I'll tell you an old trick. Hey. What's your problem?
Draw it again. Draw it again. You're the ace field man, draw it again. Just a simple diagram, just draw it again. Draw what you saw.
Draw it again! Draw it again!
Two shooters. Car comes through here. Shooters across from each other, kill each other dead.
Oh my, where'd you learn that? Huh?
In a regiment.
What regiment was that?
The 22nd Special Air Service.
What's the color of the boathouse at Hereford? What's the color of the boathouse at Hereford?
I don't like your attitude.
The color of the boathouse.
Oh, fuck off! Oh,
you got the gun, I'm unarmed. Do something. Go ahead, do something. Do something. Do something.
Tell me about an ambush. Tell me about an ambush. I ambushed you with a cup of coffee.
You'll get your money when we get the kiss.
The others too.
That is what I understood. Come on, we've gotten the word. We're moving.
And can I just say, the people on our Discord, Jason, have a habit of maybe influenced, I would say largely influenced by me, and but slightly by Katie Walsh, great Katie Walsh, that occasionally they pick a drinking game with the movies that they're doing. Now,
yes,
in Miami Vice, much to everyone's pain, it's drink whenever you hear the word loads. And
oh, dear.
And that's ambulance call inducing. And please do not. Some of the guys have suggested, oh, whenever you hear what's in the case, you take a drink. And I want to just say on mic, please don't.
Yeah. Please don't. Please don't.
And One Hit Minute Productions takes no responsibility if you do.
Nope. This is your official legal disclaimer. but Mamet does love a MacGuffin. You know, and this is textbook MacGuffin, but also and knows, as Hitchcock did, that what's in the case is wildly unimportant.
Yes.
What's in the case is no more important than the color of the boathouse at Hereford. Yes. Like the specifics of it don't matter. It's the idea of it that matters. God, it's such a good script. Okay, so Mamet. Okay, so I was Mamet obsessed in the 90s. Like, I would like this was an opening night movie for me, because I would say that my obsession with Mamet in the 90s was roughly equal to my obsession with De Niro in the 90s. Yeah. So the idea of like these two, you know, working together on this thing is wild. There was just something, you know, I got hooked by the film of Glengarry Glen Ross, as I think that was a lot of people our age's entry point.
Yeah.
But I was like all in, like whatever he was doing after that, I was into. And the thing that's fun about him is that, yes, he was this such a unique blend of an artist who had, you know, who came from the theater, who started a theater company, who was very much a theatrical purist, who's very much a a script purist, and if you've read his book about acting, you understand how much he believes that really is the only thing that matters. I love that book. It's so insane.
It is an insane book, but it's just fun. It's like, yeah, of course he said that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah, it's like, yeah. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, what it's great for, the book we're talking about is what, True or False. Is that what's called True or False, or True and False?
Yeah.
Which, you know, he posits as this like guide for acting, and it's really what it really is.
True and False, heresy and common sense for the actor.
Right. Like he positions it like it's some sort of an acting guide, and it's not. It's a guide for acting in David Mamet plays. Yeah. Like the advice that he's giving is extremely helpful if you're in a Mamet show. It's worthless if you're doing literally anyone else. But you know, he is this artist, he's this purist in a lot of ways, and he's also a commercial gunslinger. Like he's also a guy who, you know, simultaneous to writing and directing his own plays and starting a theater company and then writing and directing his own independent films, he's this incredible run of movies. I mean, House of Games, Things Change, Spanish Prisoner, you know, all of these great movies he's doing in the late 80s and through the 90s. He's also, a gun for hire. He's writing The Untouchables, which is a good script, but it's a commercial job, you know, and also a lot of times he's coming in credited or uncredited as a rewrite man. And that's the weird and funny and interesting story about his participation in this, which I finally, like, I used coming on as an excuse to finally, like, look into this, because it's always been something I've been sort of fascinated with, that he has the screenplay credit with under a pseudonym. But, like, nobody was fooled. First of all, because his style is so fucking distinctive. Like, there's, you know, either this is David Mamet or a really good David Mamet imitator. But that when the movie came out, like, every review that I read mentioned that this was David Mamet writing under a pseudonym. And I'm like, well, if everybody knows, then what's the fucking point of a pseudonym? But the story, unless you've told this elsewhere.
Please go into it. Later on, people will hear an exact excerpt in a future episode of what was on screen versus what was in the original script. But I love that you're setting the scene and setting the table.
Okay, great. So the screenplay, the official screenplay credit is what is the pseudonym that Mamet used? Of course,
he uses Richard Weiss.
Richard Weiss. So the credits are story by J.D. Zeik, Z-E-I-K, screenplay by J.D. Zeik and Richard Weiss. Now, Richard Weiss is David Mamet's pseudonym. And as I understand it, the first writer that we mentioned there, sorry.
J.D. Zeik.
J.D. Zeik wrote the original screenplay to Ronan.
Yep.
And then after Frankenheimer came on, he hired Mamet to do a pass on it. What is sort of in dispute and was taken to the Writers Guild to determine, et cetera, was the extent of that rewrite.
Yes.
And at the time that the movie came out, there was a story about this in the Los Angeles Times, actually a couple months before the movie came out. And John Frankenheimer is credited as saying, the credits should read, story by J.D. Zeik, screenplay by David Mamet. We didn't shoot a line of Zeik's script. He later, in a subsequent interview or somewhere, backed off of that. In a way that very much sounded like he had been told to rephrase that. But what Mamet had done was, Mamet had been, just the previous fall, because it came out right at the end of 97, he had been credited as the co-writer on the screenplay of Wag the Dog.
Yes.
And was nominated for an Oscar for that. The story that was going around at the time that movie came out was that his Wag the Dog script was a page one rewrite, much as Frankenheimer initially said this was a page one rewrite. That he he took the story and the structure and the bones, but did a full on Mamet overhaul, and felt in that case, and I believe that one went to arbitration as well, that the previous writer should have just been credited for story, and he should have had the sole screenplay credit, which of course would have meant more once you're Oscar nominated. And so the sort of the resolution that he made after the Wag the Dog affair was that from here on out, he was only going to take credit under his name for scripts that he wrote by himself. And yes, that if he was doing this kind of gun for hire rewrite work, that he would do it under a pseudonym or he would take no credit at all, which I assume he's also done some of. So that, again, that's sort of what's in question. Even the people who, you know, like J.D. Zeig's lawyer, I think, who is quoted in this L.A. Times story, even says, though, like, well, Frankenheimer, all he did was he came in and beefed up the De Niro part and added the female love interest. And it's like, she's much more than a female love interest.
She's the actual boss of the heist. She's the orchestrator and architect of it. She's the recruiter. She's deeply entangled.
Maybe that character existed in the J.D. Zeig script and was a man, and Mamet turned her into a woman and did the romantic. Romantic seems like a stretch, but it is a stretch.
Yeah. The romance is clearly Jean Reno and De Niro. Let's all be really clear.
Absolutely. But that if that was all that he added, that's still like not an insignificant amount. But all I will say on this particular subject is, as a borderline Mametologist,
yes,
as someone who read pretty much everything he wrote up until he went nuts.
The recent unpleasantness.
Up until the recent unpleasantness.
In the parlance of Ronan. Yeah. Up until that,
this is a fucking David Mamet screenplay. Like, there's every line of dialogue in this thing feels like a line of David Mamet dialogue. And the thing, the sort of the benefit of hindsight that we can take advantage of is you can go to IMDb and you can look at J.D. Zeig's subsequent credits.
Yes.
As a writer, yes, which are a TV movie of Witchblade, the writer of something called The Touch from 2002, a straight-to-video movie from 2008 called Pistol Whipped, and a TV movie from 2016 called Henry the Ninth. I have a feeling that if he had written more of that Ronan script, this would not be what that subsequent filmography would look like. Just my opinion.
I think your feeling when we get to the episode, your hunch will be what we're doing right now is we're pushing in on the coffee right at the beginning or something, and we're hinting to something bigger, but what you're going to see is just how essential it is. And you totally get it with these things. But if you are examining things as deeply as I have, like an inclination to do, it's like, I find it very difficult. Like, the story clear that if the story had these beats, has a hell of a lot of potential. Great.
Yes.
Structurally, you're like, ooh, I could eat this up. Sequencing, scenes, crescendo, basic structures. But every single character beat is so Mamet. It's inescapable. I've watched this movie countless times. You know, like you're like, I've seen it like 30 times. I'm like, definitely on that wavelength of a kind of movie I've seen so many times. And I think also the one last thought I would have is, which will lead into our next episode, is Jason, as a dad, I feel like right now you and I, we've aged so well into this movie rewatchability. It's like such a dad movie. Like, I think if you're out there and you're dating a lovely woman or man, and you're trying to impress their family, and at some point you're going to meet their dad.
Yeah.
You can be sure that if they've never seen Ronin, you're doing them a huge favor. I really feel like it's a peak dad movie in that regard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. I agree 100%. Yeah. And the only other thing that I would add to is I think one of the things that's fun about this movie is it is you start to see the tip towards the last from like the last great period of Mamet's creativity, which is the period from about 2001 to 2006-07 when he decided to try his hand at being an action auteur.
Yes.
Like when, like I think that Heist, Spartan, and to a lesser extent Red Belt are some of the best of his stuff that nobody ever talks about, because those movies came out and didn't make any money, and it was sort of, this was seen as sort of this unsuccessful experiment. But this is him learning that craft. Like, I think coming in with that good structure that you're talking about in place and learning how to build an action movie around it, how to slightly tweak the way he writes dialogue so that it works in an action movie, how to use his wit to subvert action tropes.
Yes.
Like
Heist is another movie in that run that absolutely. I am boundlessly impressed by. And like the Delroy Lindo's final lines in that movie.
Yep.
Like linger with me. Like even to this day, when someone asked me the other day, who's the most underrated actor working? I'm like, yeah. Delroy Lindo.
Absolutely.
He's like,
absolutely.
He should be on a God tier level. And people are like, oh yeah, he's in a TV show. It's like, no, that guy should have like 3 Oscars. And it's,
agreed.
It's crazy. But yeah, you're so right about like exactly that subversion. That's what is fantastic about these scenes. It's like in moments that you can feel the structure screaming for some really boring exposition, Mamet just has a poetic flair that is completely unforgettable, and then you just move on and you keep the plot moving. Yep. You know,
yeah, you're worried about saving your own skin. I am. It covers my body.
Yeah,
that's the good shit right there. Right there.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Here is Jordan Harper.
Well, yeah, and you know, I think the thing first off with Mamet is he is the classic example of the had it, lost it. I mean, his talent is absolutely undeniable. You cannot deny the power of Glengarry Glen Ross. You know, when he started directing films himself, I think you started to see the rickety parts pretty quickly. Even in the movies like House of Games that I adore, there's the thing that he makes all of his female actresses who he always marries behave as robots or just very inhuman. Lindsay Krause is a fine actress, but you watch House of Games, you're like, what the fuck? That's not how people are. Like, that's not how people are. And I still love that movie. I love Mamet's dialogue. And I have read a good deal of Mamet's theoretical work on writing and storytelling and acting. And I find his theoretical work really interesting and really important for my development. And I think one of the main things is how little time he spends in his theoretical work discussing dialogue.
Yes.
He doesn't write about that. And this is, I might've talked, Jen Johansson and I did a huge Mamet episode that I had a lot of fun with her. And you know, he has very clear theories about what acting should be that I find a great appeal in as somebody who writes and thinks that whatever happens needs to be on the page, and that it is about oppositional forces and it is about almost a game that you enter into. I don't think he ever uses that term, but a game you enter into with another person to gain something. And it is always about an intention and an execution of that intention. And he has a natural facility with dialogue that he doesn't know how to explain, because he never writes about it. He never writes about how he finds these gems of language. He spends very little time talking about, like, you know, what a scene is, other than in his frankly good, if very arrogant, memo to the unit that he wrote to his writer's room in the unit, where he's, you know, a scene is about your protagonist achieving or failing a goal. And when that goal is achieved, you get out of the scene. And, you know, and that is, and so I think learning that, but also learning the lessons of the pleasures of intelligently crafted dialogue that bounces off each other and has these interesting ideas, and it's never a straight line with him. That's been huge to me. Now, I will tell you, though, when I first came to Ronin, I remember, I think I was in college when Ronin kind of hit like the last of the VCR racks.
Yeah,
you know what
was,
I mean?
As it was last of the VCR, and also like tip of the spear DVD. Like,
yes.
I really want to know to this day, and there's been a lot of mentions on the show so far, is like, I want to know how many copies of Ronin sold on DVD. I would imagine that it probably made $150 million in DVD sales.
And it made those DVD sales on the backs of the car chases.
Yes.
That was when because I remember I was in college, and the bros, these were not film bros, these were bros. It was, oh, this movie has the greatest car chases that have ever been filmed. And I know you're going to have a lot of people come in and talk about those things, and they are magnificent. And I will say, at the time, I liked the dialogue, but it was not what got me. Now, when I watch it, it's the dialogue.
It's music, Jordan. That's one thing you were beautifully describing, is he can't describe the alchemy, I think, just to tag on your point. He can't describe it because it turns... It's like someone writing little stupid pictures on a page that are actual music. And then when you sit at the piano and you play them, like someone speaks mm-hmm. them into existence, or strums them into existence, or points them into existence, they have a transcendent quality. It's just like he can't understand the gap between writing that quippy thing and then when De Niro says it. You know, yeah, I care about my skin. It covers my body. That's an amazing line to write, and you must go, oh, that's pretty cool. But then when he says it in the movie and it's in the music of the movie, it's like, oh shit, this thing is incredible.
And I do think that, you know, as somebody who thinks about writing on a technical and theoretical level a lot, there are things you can't teach. Or if you do teach them, a screenwriting book is not the place to learn that. It is either in an acting class, which is where Mamet spent a lot of time, both as an actor and as somebody who directs actors. And I think he learned a tremendous amount from that. But I also just think, like, there are some things you either have it or you don't. You know, you can learn the chords, but you can't learn the music. Like, to your point, like, the music is something that comes out of you, and that is where he shines. And, you know, there's like little things, like in the recent Unpleasantness, I think. When he's talking to Stellan Skarsgård.
Yes.
This is the recent Unpleasantness, and just a million little things, you know, hey, lady, I don't walk into a place I don't know how to walk out of. Like, just, and to the point, you know, when you get through this whole movie, and this is a very Mamet-y idea. And so I don't know if it was in the drafts before he started writing this, but I have to assume this is his addition, is it's about the case. It's about the case. It's about the case. It's not about the case. It's about the guy picking up the case. Like, that is such a great turn. Never revealing the case is content.
I need a sporting instant replay of how perfectly you just encapsulated this movie. It's about the case. It's about the case. It's about the case. It's not about the case. It's like, yeah. You idiot. It's about the guy carrying the case.
And, you know, not to go too far afield here, but I had seen Glengarry Glen Ross, I'm sure through my parents watching it when I was young, and I loved it. But, you know, as I remember, I went and saw The Spanish Prisoner in the theater. I think probably because Steve Martin was in it, if I'm being honest, because I was like a teenager, and having my mind fucking blown by all of the, it was one of the first times I ever walked out of a movie, like being blown away by the writing of it.
Yeah.
And specifically those technical details of like all of these little things that seem like they don't matter that end up mattering. Even, and again, I'd seen a version of this in the first place, but his idea of the MacGuffin, which is what the case is, or in The Spanish Prisoner, it's a process.
Yes.
And what the process does is it will generate a windfall. Yeah, Ricky Jay explains all this at the very beginning. And then he says, and it will generate a windfall of, and then you hear him writing on the chalkboard and you never see the number. And I had never, I don't think, been experienced consciously that idea of it's so much cooler not to see the number. You see all the guys like lean forward after he writes the number. And that's like, that's so much stronger than some number that would seem small to us now.
Yes.
You know, 20 years later or whatever, it's been 30 probably at this point. That's such a stronger idea. And so I had never heard that. And I had never like seen that articulated. And so like, that was, I think, really the beginning of me falling in love with what he could do with genre films. And again, like we can roll this in because sometime we should talk about Heist by itself, which to me is a deeply flawed movie, but the dialogue in it, I think, is the best of Mamet's whole career outside of Glengarry Glen Ross is separate. But
the Delroy Lindo monologue at the end of Heist is one of the greatest pieces of dialogue ever written, and Delroy Lindo delivers it with such finesse because it's such an important scene. And forever, I actually said the other day, someone was like, "Who do you think is an underrated actor?" And I'm like, Delroy Lindo is the most underrated actor I've ever seen, because the guy can be in a movie, he can be in a dumb like procedural TV show, he can be in all sorts of genres. And if they ask him to come and play, the guy did Defy Bloods with Spike Lee, and I'm like, and he gives the like Brando level performance, and just people ignored it. And I was like, what is going on in the universe that you're not seeing what I'm seeing? This guy's unbelievable.
He's unbelievable. It's a small role, but he's unbelievable in Malcolm X.
Oh.
He is unbelievable in Heist. He's got so many great. He's got a why did the chicken cross the road? Because the road crossed the chicken. so many of these things that like almost don't make sense. Danny DeVito is also, again, an underrated actor and born to deliver Mamet dialogue.
Because he's DeVito has comedic timing like a tap dancer.
Yes.
And in drama, he can still keep that tempo. So he can, he's like, I know that this is going to sound like me, you know, extorting someone, but it's funnier if I dance, like if I keep it in my tempo, and he just fires out the dialogue and you're like, oh, he's amazing. He's the best thing in Francis Ford Coppola's The Rainmaker for the same reason. He's just like, he's this grubby little, you know, corrupt lawyer. And he just, I'm like, oh yeah, like a whole movie with him. Forget Matt Damon. I want this grubby little Danny DeVito performance.
He's got one of my favorite Mamet lines in the history of it all is his line in that movie of everybody needs money. That's why they call it money. So I saw somebody one time try to argue that was a terrible line of dialogue because it didn't make sense. And it's like, you are stupid. It's a brilliant line of dialogue because it doesn't make sense. Like,
yeah,
it's anyway, and you know, before I pivot all of that into Ronan, I want to dovetail off and just sing the praises of Sean Bean for just a second. What a terrific actor. I had the opportunity last year to Zoom with Andrew Garfield for business related reasons, and I was like, I'm never going to get a chance to do this. I have to do my Sean Bean impression for Andrew Garfield because I love the Red Riding movies, particularly the first one in which Sean Bean delivers. Now I did it for Andrew Garfield, so I'll do it for you. It's like, but now it's totally falling on my head how to do it. It's like, we like to folk and make a book, but we're not right choosy how we do it. Which again, you're talking about like great dialogue. That is from the novel. We like to fuck and make a buck, but it's what we like to folk and make a book. which I think weirded Andrew Garfield out when I did it.
That guy can't be weirded out. Andrew Garfield's a weird guy. I think that's why his energy is so good in movies, is because he's weird. You like that.
And he's great.
And terrific. That wasn't a slight. I love the weird of Andrew Garfield. He's wonderful.
No, and I particularly, I mean, Red Riding is my favorite performance from him, and I told him that when I met him. But Sean Bean is so good in Ronan, and it is such a lousy part to have to play, because he's really not given anything admirable or nice to hold on to. You don't like him. He's sort of set up at the beginning to be the guy you don't like, so you'll just like Jean Reno more, because Jean Reno is only given nice things. And he's great. I love Jean Reno in this movie. He's so charming. But Sean Bean is set up from the beginning of like, well, that's a wanker. I don't call people wankers, but I'm pretty sure I'm using it.
No, you are.
Correctly.
He is absolutely a wanker. You're just like, oh, get a grip on yourself. Please.
I mean, I'm a weapons man. Who says that? Who calls themselves a weapons man?
He does get one little glimpse, though, which is cool. I do really like that he can speak French. I really like that he can speak French. It's like that one glimpse. But it is such an essential role, despite its thanklessness, that if the person's not committed to giving it absolutely everything, then the movie stinks.
Yeah.
But he gives it. He's turned up to 11. He is just firing in this movie.
The journey he goes on at the end of the heist, the end of the gun mission, where it's like, you know, we got the guns, we got the money. That's a job well done. And to pivot from that to puking is so terrific.
It's so bad.
But to get back, so you're talking about Mammoth, you're talking about what a scene is. A scene is an intention that you have meeting an intention that somebody else has. And this is very clear. Sean Bean is there to, you know, blanket over his gleaming insecurity. That is his intention in the scene. Again, they don't really hide it. You're not shocked to find out he's a poser at the end of the scene. His insecurity is gleaming from the first moment you meet, and his job is to hide that. And De Niro in this film, they don't even really, I know they have names, but they barely don't. They really don't have names in this movie.
Character's name is Sam, but it's inconsequential. It's only for that one second that he introduces himself to Jean Reno's Vincent. He's like, you know, Sam, my name is Vincent.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of like, they don't really say each other's names for the rest of the movie. They don't need to.
No, so it is De Niro who's, that's the name of the character as far as I'm concerned. And, you know,
in between movies, just doing a heist with Jean Reno.
Yeah. And he is in this position where he has just been exposed to danger because of this man's incompetence. And so his intention in the scene is exposure, right? That is what he is here. He is here to expose Sean Bean's incompetence so that he is not going to be placed in danger by this man any longer. So you have the great moment. It's a little obvious that you can't do crossfire when you're doing an ambush. You can't literally shoot at each other, but it's great. It's again, it's this demand of draw it again. Yeah. And just like pressing on that thing. And Sean Bean is instantly on the back foot, but he's still not breaking all the way. And so it gets to this, this esoteric question, right? What is the color of the boathouse?
At Hereford.
Yes. Thank you. And this is such a perfect Mammoth idea, because there's the brute mechanics of it is, this is a man intent on exposing someone. How do you expose them? Well, you expose them by asking a question they won't know the answer to. And that's very good. The strangeness of what is the color of the boathouse at Hereford is like, feels, that's right. That's what you would ask, right? You would ask, what is the color boathouse in Hereford? And then you have the other very elegant thing, which is the physicality of the question is a feint. It's a distraction for the cup of coffee.
Yeah.
You know, because that's actually where the turn happens, is I'm going to press this man. It's not the fact that he can't answer the question. It's that he gets pushed to a place where he's almost going to become violent about it, at which point he is, in the classic line, ambushed with a cup of coffee. And And the scene ends because Sean Bean is revealed
as a poser.
And that's the end of the scene. He is, and so what happens afterwards is just a little filigree, and it's very nice. Is somebody, I think it's Stellan Skarsgård, asks, "What is the color of the boathouse at Hereford?" And Daenerys says, "Well, how should I know?" which that is like, I think that little beat right there, even it's filigree. And again, this thing, Mamet will always write like he doesn't put filigree in, but he does. This is filigree. But that's what makes Mamet a genius, or genius is a strong word, very, very brilliant when he was good, is that little moment of, oh, right, it also doesn't matter what the color of the boathouse in Hereford is. Because if he had answered it, De Niro either would have said, no, it's not, or he would have asked the second question. You know, like, that was not the thing. The thing was not actually testing him. It was getting him against that table so that he would knock the coffee over. And it's just
starts,
so...
And he starts... Right from, there's no escalation. He puts the coffee cup there so much before any thing happens. He's like, I'm going to expose this guy. That I love how you said there's the intention, the action, exposure. So he puts the coffee cup there a good sight before he gets there. It's just then, which of these things am I going to hang this guy with? One of them is, how stupid. Try it again. Like, you don't know the details.
Yeah.
You don't like you don't know anything. You're not prepared. Firstly, that's the start. And then, like, you're not a weapons man. These are shooting. So where the fuck did you learn that? And then it's only that he then digs his own grave. He's like, Special Air Service. And you're like, the 100-something regiment of the Special Air Service. He's like, oh, I've got you now.
Yeah. Yeah. I can just, but you're right. I believe he is literally, like watching him draw the bad diagram, and he places the cup of coffee down because it's like, okay, this has gone too far. We almost got killed because he walked into that tunnel he should have never walked into. And now he is proposing like a plan that will get us killed.
And the only reason we got out is because Vincent shot the guy. I shot the guy under the bridge with Vincent. Vincent took out some guys, Skip Sutter, whose character is Larry, like whips the car in there and jet sets them out of there. But it's very high stakes.
It is. It's incredibly, again, and the action scenes in this movie are so well done. Even when they strike, they are slightly ludicrous. They have that great element of really good pulp where there's just enough realism salted into it that you're watching the most ludicrous car chase you've ever seen, but it feels like that's what it would be like. You know, they're going 100 miles an hour the wrong way down a highway and just like dodging traffic, but there's just, it's all salted with that feeling of realism that I think that's the key. As I always said, that realism is a tool, not a goal.
Yes.
You want your realism to be there to ground the people so that you can do all the fantastic things that you want to do. Unless you're truly making like some kind of, kitchen sink drama, which is not my genre, so I don't think about this. But that is what I mean. Again, you see,
and the only way that you can do that in Paris is to have like 70 race car drivers on closed roads who know how to drive, and you know, all the cars going the wrong way are going 30 miles an hour, and the cars that are going the right way are going 100 because there's like a pattern that they can drive through. And there's like 60 people on planet Earth who could fucking drive like that without the cars hitting each other. And it's like, the guy who's actually driving is holding a micro steering race car steering wheel in the, you know, front passenger seat while De Niro and Natasha McElhone are like hanging on for dear life.
I recently saw for the first time in my career, I can't remember the name for it, a car where they put a steering wheel on the roof.
There's a pod car. It's called a pod car where they put a platform outside the car or on the roof so the actors can be in there. It's sometimes called a pod car or roof pods or something like that where they just have them in. But in those tunnels, they didn't have them in a pod. They had driver in the passenger seat. Oh, they did have a pod sometimes, but most of the time it was in that passenger seat because they were going hell for leather through those through those winding people. But yeah, it's I love your description of that. It's a fantastic performance, and again, so thankless, but he has to ice it so perfectly so the whole rest of the movie has the momentum of like, oh, now these guys are ready. And I think also the ludicrousness of some of the we've now lost a guy, so we need a tactical advantage. You know, grenade mm-hmm. launchers and bazookas and machine guns then become like the best sort of way to counter this challenge of no longer having the right number of people. It's crazy. It's right. great.
Oh, it's great. It's great. And I love it. I do think you kind of, I mean, Stellan Skarsgård is such a good villain in this movie, but I think you miss Sean Bean. You know, they don't do a Wayne Grove, bring him back to rat him out to somebody.
But don't I love that scene? You talk about filigree. There's that great scene when they're leaving their first safe house, which is like, here's your money. I don't need to remind you that you need to forget us. Like, or something.
Yeah.
So something, whatever she says, that line is like, I will kill you in an instant. If you ever even mention that you were on this job, you'll be dead. And he believes it.
Yes. Yeah. And therefore there is no Wayne growing. No, I just, you know, again, I just really, I
love that
him
we're now using Wayne grow as a verb.
It's a verb. So, you know what I meant.
I know exactly what you You said it for me.
Language is a growing creature, you know? I do miss him in the rest of the film, even though there's so many other just like great moments and great characters. And really just a phenomenal cast all the way around. Everybody from what's his name? Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah.
As the, I guess, head of the an active member of the IRA, which I don't think they ever specify, right? They don't ever
there's
say
a lot of, there's
IRA,
a lot of recent unpleasantness that is being referred to in this movie.
Yes.
Just European recent unpleasantness. So
And Jean Reno is great, obviously. De Niro, what a, you know, it's a not his like most dynamic performance, but it's just, it doesn't need to be. He's just locked into this like very Parker-esque kind of role, you know.
Yeah, he's it's one of those true performances where they're like, where you can tell he'd sort of trust Frankenheimer and trust the dialogue so much that he's just like, we don't need you to bring extra. In fact, there's going to be something about your persona rather than your practice that, like, you're a tough streetwise guy and you've got a lot of experience. And so I think that Sam and De Niro, and you go into these situations and you pretend. And so it's like the most kind of like intertextual performance of his in some ways, because it's like, we want you to go into this situation and pretend, and you're going to be lying to everyone. And there's kind of that weird distance between like acting is just a big case of pretend and everyone has to kind of buy into the pretend. And in the same way, these guys are all pretending. They've all got like different motivations. They're all kind of like, it's not just about the case. It's not about the case. I love your little description. It's not about the case. That's kind of what's so brilliant about it. So he just gets to just settle in and exactly like in that much more Mamet way is like, let breathe through the dialogue. Just everything about the performance is about the dialogue, all the things in between the lines that aren't being said. So great. Like, all the obviousness is stripped away. So it's just him. His ability to infer it between the lines is so good. That's the first thing they teach you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. There is a lot of empty space. And I think that De Niro is exactly the kind of guy who can fill that space, you know? Yeah. And it's a very, again, it's surprising. Like, he's not even credited, right? Mamet's name is not on this.
No, it's because he wrote the screenplay as Richard Weiss at the time, because J.D. Zeick, who wrote the original script, he wrote an amazing mechanism and an incredible structure. But it was so much more explicit and expository that Mamet just went in and wholesale, like, just kept the structure and just killed 90% of the dialogue. Like, he just, as in, not in a bad way, just all the exposition, all of the obviousness, he just like cloaked the whole thing in Mamet and did so much of a rewrite that, other than the structure, like, where I think they were originally going to give him a story credit. And I think because this movie is so much about the dialogue, like, it's got the structure and it's got the story, there's some additions. And at the time, Frankenheimer was pretty gung-ho. He was like, we didn't shoot a single word in a script by J.D. Zeich. It was all David Mamet. But I think for arbitration purposes, they were going to say the story, like the bones of the story were J.D. Zeich, and then Mamet wrote the screenplay. But Mamet didn't want that. So he just ended up saying, no, put it under a pseudonym. I don't want credit.
Well, that's good. You see, he was capable of decentness back then too. That's very decent of him. And suggests that he might have a humanity that he has peeled away a little bit. I don't know. Again, like you really talk about a guy who really produced some just phenomenal works. I mean, State and Main. I just adore that movie, and it has a real heart. It really does. It has like a real heart. And it's funny, like, you know, and that he has that kind of range to write Glengarry Glen Ross, State and Main, and this. I mean, that's a true talent, you know?
Yeah. And then Hannibal for Ridley Scott.
Did he write Hannibal?
He wrote Hannibal. He's got an amazing, like, it's an amazing, like he wrote all the way back to, like, he wrote The Verdict, Untouchables, House of Games, Homicide, Glengarry, Hoffa. Then he goes like American Buffalo, The Edge, Wag the Dog, which he was Academy nominated for. And then he goes and does things like The Winslow Boy, which is like first directorial effort, very kind of like chamber piece. Hannibal, State and Main and Hannibal are a year apart. And then he does Hannibal for Ridley Scott, and then he does writes and directs Heist in the same year. Spartan. Crazy.
He was also getting those, like, this was back in the day where they would pay somebody like him $1 million to do a pass on some script that he would never get his name on, you know, and didn't leave his thumb on or his thumbprint on as much as other stuff. But he was in that club as well.
Yeah.
You know, like with Joe Esterhaus and people like that, these kind of guys who get, well, will you spend 6 weeks on it? We'll give you $1 million and we'll never use your name. And I eagerly await the day that somebody wants to put me in that club.
That's a gig. That's a gig.
You'd never see my name on a TV script again. I would just, you're kidding me, just like big suitcases of money. Esterhaus always had it in his contracts, because this was back in the day that they, for the period of time he was drafting, you had to put him in the Chateau Marmont.
Beautiful. That's a deal that I want for you.
Well, me too. But we don't live in that era anymore. You know, that was, again, he sold the Basic Instinct for $10 million. And by the way, they made money on that deal. Anybody thinks he was overpaid.
Oh, they made so much. That culturally, yeah. Talk about video and DVD money. They fucking made some money.
They made their money. Yeah. And that is a movie that relies heavily on, I mean, obviously Verhoeven. And Sharon Stone and Michael Douglas have a tremendous amount to do with it as well. But, like, you know, that guy was a shark, man. Like, it was a true shark. And that's far afield. But no, it's Mamet was tremendous, just tremendous. And even the movies that Spartan has huge flaws, totally falls apart at the end. God, I love to watch the first, I don't know, hour of that movie. And I have so many times, just because Val Kilmer is another person who's perfect to do.
Oh, yeah.
It. And, you know, he was on the downslope of his career at that point, but it was great because it made him do this movie that, you know, there are those great Val Kilmer movies that he probably never wanted to play, like Salt and Sea, you know.
And that's a great performance. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Salt and Sea.
Yeah.
Great performance.
Yeah. Absolutely ludicrous. Post Tarantino movie there, but like, but good fun, and he's really good at it, you know. I love Mamet's work, and I stand as somebody very much influenced by him. And I think that, again, you can take this one scene of the boathouse and kind of learn almost every trick he has is going to be in here. It's very simple, and again, I do recommend aspiring writers should hear me say it's a very arrogant letter and then read the letter he wrote to his writer's room, because I think there's a tremendous amount of truth in it.
That
That concludes episode 4 of Rome Men. Thank you so much to my amazing guests, Jordan Harper, Jason Bailey, and Ben David Grabinski, taking a break from post-production to chat. Thank you, gents. To find out more about the show or all of our shows, oneheatminute.com or at OHM Pods on the socials. But now it's time to go to 31 minutes and 23 seconds. And please, take a photo with my wife. Won't you take a photo with my wife?